Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO for episode number 28 with Don Ledger. He gets right into Shag Harbor, tells the entire story. A couple of quick announcements. You can like us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter. Those icons are right on our website. My email address is info@podcastufo.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy today's show.
The thumbnail sketch for Shag Harbor, October the 4th, 1967, approximately 11:25 in the evening, and this would have been a Wednesday night. A young fisherman by the name of Laurie Wickens and four passengers are driving to the southwest on Old Highway Number 3 in Nova Scotia, heading in towards Shag Harbor. They're coming back from a community affair over in Cape Sable Island, not far away. Up on the right-hand side of the car, they spot this sequence of lights, four to five flashing lights that seem to be paralleling them as they go along this old curvy old highway. And then it pulls ahead of them, and it starts to turn down at, looks like, about a 45-degree angle and heading down towards the water. The water would have been on the left side. They would have been close to the water at certain points, and then the highway would go inland a bit, and then back close to the harbor. They went into Shag Harbor, but they were still seeing it when they went up what's a place called Chapel Hill, which is a high point in Shag Harbor, and they could see the thing then heading back more closely down towards the water, still flashing in that four to five light sequence. And it's crossing in front of the car now. They go through Shag Harbor. They go up the other side past Prospect Point, which is on the west side of Shag Harbor, and disappears behind the trees as they get past Prospect Point. They lose it at that point and quickly go around behind the trees and see that it's disappeared. They come up to what's called the old Irish moss plant, which was a processing plant there for Irish moss that grows in off the shores of Nova Scotia. They get iodine or something out of it. Anyway, they pull onto the parking lot, which is right on the edge of the water at this point. So they get out and they look and they can see what looks like a pale yellow light on top of some dark appearing thing out on the water, dark object if you want to call it that. Which is what the military calls it. And it looks like it's either floating or under its own power and drifting maybe with the current or under its own power further out to sea. It looks to be about maybe 800 feet offshore. They think, wow, what's this? This looks like, they thought an airplane had crashed into the harbor, okay? So Laurie says, well, I think the best thing we can do is go down further down the road to Lower Woods Harbor, which is only like a quarter of a mile to a half mile away, and there's a payphone down there, and we can call the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which has a detachment back in Barrington Passage, which would be behind them further up to the northeast. They do that. Laurie calls up. He gets Victor Wabicki, the corporal, in charge that night. And he relays to Victor that what had happened. They thought an airplane had just crashed into the harbor. And he asked Laurie if he'd been drinking. Laurie was 18 years old at the time, and he was a young fisherman. Hmm. And he said, no, I haven't been drinking. He said, Wabicki's phone started to ring. So he got the phone number for the phone booth from Laurie and told him to stay there, and he called him back. So he answers the phone, and it's a woman from over in Maggie Guerin's Point, which is right beside the Sound, which is between Shag Harbor and the Sound. That's the name of a location on water there between Oder Island and the shore. And this woman says she thought an airplane had just crashed into the Sound. In the meantime, the phone rings again. A fellow from Beer Point, which is maybe three or four miles to the east, calls up, had called them and said, I think I just saw an airplane crashing into the harbor, which from his vantage point would look like the harbor because the Sound's just on the other side of it. And another phone call comes in from a woman who was returning from the same function that Lori and them were, and her and her daughter thought they saw an airplane going down into the water off Shag Harbor. So he's taking it seriously now. He makes a call back to Lori, tells him, get back in this car, get back to the Irish Moss plant, sit there and keep an eye on the thing. In the meantime, he makes a radio call to a squad car that he's got out that's actually down in the Lower Woods Harbor area with two Mounties in it, and they have a clearing staked out, looking, hoping to catch some deer jackers that have been active in the area, deer poachers, if you want to call them. They're called deer jackers up here. Hunting season used to open early in October and ended the end of November up here back in those days. Now it's just 1 month in November. So anyway, in the meantime, Dave Kendrick and Norm Smith are coming back in their little car, their Chevy 2, I think it was, coming back from the same function on the same highway, heading in the same direction, either slightly before or slightly after. We haven't been able to determine that yet. When Norm Smith spots this series of lights going across the sky beside them, paralleling the car and then pulling around in front and then disappearing behind the trees. Dave Kendrick drops Norm Smith off at his uncle's place, where he's staying, and then he goes home, tells his mother about the weird thing they saw in the sky, goes to bed, and that's the end of it for Dave Kendrick. But in the meantime, Norm Smith gets out of the car, and as Dave Kendrick's car is disappearing around a turn, he happens to glance up in the sky, and he sees a series of lights crossing over the tree line. So he runs inside, gets his uncle, who's a fisherman, who's just getting ready to go to bed because they get up early, comes running out with him in his house coat, and they look and they see this thing, and they said, geez, that looks like it's a plane or something crashing over toward Shag Harbor. And they both say, we better get over there. So his uncle goes back inside to get some clothes on, and he comes out, and as they're getting into the car, the two Mountie cars go by, heading over to Shag Harbor. There's an ambiguity here that bothered me when I first got involved in this case with Chris Stiles. Anyway, anyway, sure enough, they go over. When they get there, the two Mounties are sitting there. Lori Wickens and his four passengers are there now, and probably a half a dozen other people that have showed up because they've got curious. They pulled into the parking lot. They sit there, and they watch this pale yellow light on the water that seems to be sitting, as according to Ron O'Brien, who was one of the Mounties there, seemed to be sitting on top of something that was about 60 feet wide and maybe between 8 and 12, 3 feet from the top to the bottom, elongated, maybe like a lens shape you've seen from the edge. And I said, could you see any detail on it? When I interviewed him some years ago, and he said, no, it's just, just black up there and barely discernible. And I said, well, could this have been a light from a buoy out there? And he said, no, all the people that were there, they're all fishermen. He said, they know where the buoys are. He said, this thing was in the wrong place to be a buoy. You know, there was all kinds of, maybe it's a submarine or something like that. Anyway, the thing of it is, everybody thinks this is a crashed airplane, mm-hmm. Right? Victor says to Ron O'Brien, I want you to call RCC in Halifax, Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax, and see if anything's missing, which is what they do.
Yeah.
That's a combination of the Coast Guard and the Air Force and the Navy, so on and so forth, the rescue center. Same as your coast. It operates the same as it does basically in the States. Anyway, he said, I'm going to go and see if I can get a couple of fishermen to take their boats out, and we'll go out and start looking. And they'd even considered taking a dory that was tied up behind the Irish Moss plant on the water there, but they figured it was too risky. The night was cool, clear. The waters were calm. The tide was ebbing. No moon or anything like that in the sky. So anyway, they both were ready to leave, and at that point, the light vanished out on the water. It just disappeared all of a sudden. So they're starting to take it seriously now. They think whatever it was out there drifting on the water is now sunk. Ron Pond, the other Mountie, the third Mountie, is left there to take statements from the witnesses. Ron O'Brien contacts RCC. You know, they had to go to houses and use regular phones because they didn't have the resources in those days that the police had now for communications, just car radios. And they couldn't call Halifax with that. So anyway, which is basically, a couple hundred miles up the coast almost. Mm-hmm. And Victor manages to raise The first fisherman, which is his name is Brath, B-R-A-T-H, Shand, S-H-A-N-D. Everybody calls him Brath. They call him Brath Shand. His name is Bradford Shand, actually. I'm sorry. And he said, yeah, okay. He said, I'll go out. He said, but you should call Lawrence Smith. He said, he's the last boat tied up, so he'd be the first one out. So you want to get a hold of him because he's tied to my boat, too. Plus, he's tied to the jetty. And so he'll probably go out as well. So he did. He called him, and then he got some of the fishermen that are around there, including Lori Wickens and Norm Smith and his uncle, and they went down to the government dock back in Shag Harbor because they're over at the Irish Moss Plant, about maybe a mile away or less than a mile, but close to it. And they go down, they get on the boats, and they go up in the water, and they go up the western approach to the two boats. Now, this is sometime around, we're quickly into the 5th of October now, and it's around somewhere between quarter after 12 and 12:30 by the time everything's up and running. They go out across the water, expecting to see bodies and so on floating in the water, and the first thing they come across is this the famous foam. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to love that foam. But Lawrence Smith was the first one to drift into it. He cut his engine back to idle. We're in boats that are about 35 to 40 feet in length, fishing boats. And it's really quiet. He drifts, and Brath Shand, he kills the engine on his boat. And Lawrence calls back across him. He says, what do you make of this, Brath? And Brath said, I don't know what it is. I don't much care for sailing into it. But they didn't have a choice, they figured. Now, these guys are, don't forget, they're fishermen. Some of these guys have been fishing for 50 years or 40 years, and they all know what sea foam looks like. And they said, no, this wasn't sea foam. They didn't know what it was. It looked more like shaving cream drifting around the water with a glittery yellow surface. It was about 4-inch thick. And it was about 80 feet wide, judging by the length of their boats and how long it, and it took two, it was about two boat lengths in width, and perhaps a half mile long. They continued to cut back through this and forth through the foam in the area that they suspected, there would have been wreckage or bodies drifting around or whatever. Norm Smith said his stomach was in knots because he thought he was going to see dead bodies or worse. Drifting around over there, hoping they'd find some survivors, but they never found anything, and they just kept cutting back and forth. Over on Cape Sable Island, the Coast Guard Cutter 101 had fired up its engines and took it about a half to three quarters of an hour to get across from Clark's Harbor and Cape Sable Island to the so-called crash site. When they got there, they asked to talk to Ron O'Brien, and Ronnie Newell, the skipper, relayed a message from RCC to Ron O'Brien telling them that they didn't have any airplanes, commercial, private, or military aircraft reported as missing. Mm-hmm. So everybody's wondering at that point, well, what the heck are we looking for? And nobody knew. Anyway, they continued to look around just in case, there was some kind of an ambiguity there. Some aircraft had gone in that hadn't been reported even flying in the first place, that type of thing. And they kept that going until 3 or 4 in the morning. Some of those guys had to go back home because they were they'd been up basically since about 3 o'clock the morning before, because they go out usually 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning to go fishing. And in the meantime, other boats had shown up, and by the time they were finished, they had the Coast Guard cutter, the Mounties on board, and some of the locals helping to scan around the area. They did actually put divers into the water, which were Mountie divers, who went down in the bottom looking around. And it was about 40, it's only about 40 feet deep there in that area, and very apparently clean. They didn't apparently find anything, although some of the local fishermen said they saw some of the Navy divers. This is the Navy divers, now not to be mixed up with the military coming later, taking stuff out of the water. But around a seaport, any fishing village, there's bound to be junk on the bottom. And since they might not know what it was laying there, maybe old pieces of steel or aluminum or something laying on the bottom from traps or something like that, they would bring it to the surface and let the authority figure out what it was. But this stuff, none of this stuff appeared to be anything that was from a supposedly crashed UFO or an airliner at that point. So the thing of it is, this is a highly publicized search. This is going on under the Canadian Broadcast Corporation television network is on the scene. This is at that time the biggest network in Canada, right, from coast to coast. Mm-hmm. And they had a 16 millimeter cameraman on board or in the area, and they were shooting film of them searching out in the harbor, the Mounties and the people walking around, that sort of thing. And also, military telexes are flying around between RCC and the air desk in Ottawa. The air desk in Ottawa was the RCAF air desk, and it was the last gasp of the RCAF, any kind of a UFO reporting system that they would have. And Wing Commander William Baines was on duty that night. He took the information down. He sent off instructions to Maritime Command in the Navy in Halifax, and instructed them to send divers down from the Fleet Diving Unit. By the time they got up and airborne, they were in the helicopters and sent down to Shag Harbor. It was Friday morning before they got there. They got there around noontime, and they were in the water by 1 o'clock. Mm-hmm. By 6 o'clock, they were convinced there wasn't anything to be found on the bottom of Shag Harbor. And then they were told to stay on site until further notice and keep looking, and which they found strange. Ron O'Brien, who related to the Mountie, who related this to me later on, said he thought it strange, too, because they called him and told him to tell the divers to stay on site until further notice. And he said, I don't know why they would stay on site. He said, considering they'd already determined there was nothing down there on the bottom to see anyway. And even so, the divers from the Fleet Diving Unit in Stadacona in Halifax were on site right until Sunday night, till around 8 o'clock. That's when they finished up. Hmm. And they, you know, they never found anything. And so... this was turning into a bit of a puzzle. On Saturday that day, Ray McLeod, reporter for the Halifax Herald. Now, the Halifax Herald is the biggest and one of the most conservative newspapers in eastern Canada in Halifax. It's still going. It's been going for 150 years. And it was surprising when they came up with two-inch banner red headlines that said maybe something concrete to Shag Harbor UFO-RCMP. So he was writing stories about it, and then he was taken off the story, and another reporter assigned to it because Eric Dennis, the owner of the newspaper, said he was scaring people, which is kind of stupid because it's not easy to scare people in Nova Scotia. I mean, they've had half of Halifax blow up, and one of the biggest man-made explosion up until the atom bomb when a magazine blew up, or a ship blew up in the harbor back in the First World War. Magazine blew up again in the Second World War. Fishing disasters with hundreds of fishermen dying, you know, coal mine disasters and all that sort of thing. It takes a lot to scare a maritimer in that regard. Hurricanes, you know, northern nor'easters and all that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you get the point. So anyway, it continued to go on like that. And then shortly after that, it sort of died out because the report said there was nothing there. They couldn't find anything, and blah, 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 blah. In the meantime, there was a lot of documentation of telexes. The RCMP had sent their report in. They lost their main report. We both Chris and I hunted for that thing for years. The RCMP had moved their detachment down in Barrington Passage, the one that was the active one back in the day, a couple hundred yards down the road, or a couple hundred feet down the road, actually, from their old site, and apparently the report got lost somehow, as they always do, you know, in this business. The main report, the long report, a 16-page report on what had happened that night. We'd love to get our hands on that, but we never could find it. There's a couple of telexes that describe in brief what was going on there. The paper trail between, or the documentation trail, the CFAO 72-6 UFO reporting report forms that the Canadian military used for UFOs were flying back and forth. It was the military who actually classed this thing as a UFO.
Which is really, except for the Mexican military, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, that's the only other time I've ever heard of this.
Yeah, it's a reversal of roles.
Mm-hmm, right.
It actually has it written on Squadron Leader Bain under his name on the top of one report, has UFO, and it's underlined three times. If you go onto my site, DonLedger.com, and you'll look down here. You'll look down. You'll just see some books mentioned there, but you'll see click here for further reports or something like that. I haven't actually got my site in front of me. If you click on that, that brings you into my UFO site, right? And it brings up NARCAP affiliation and so on and so forth. But it also brings up, you can also click on the Sheikh Harbor, Dark Object, click on that. And incidentally, that's where we got the name from. One of the military, the RCAF reports referred to this thing as a dark object. So we grabbed that and ran with it. Mm-hmm. Seemed like a sexy title to put on the book, right? Dark
sure.
Object.
Yeah.
Dark Object, still in print. It's still out there on in Amazon and still selling in various bookstores. It's been out now for 11 years, I guess.
No.
And but anyway, just click Dark Object on there or my name on there and it'll come up. So on Amazon, CA or in the States. I don't know about the UK. I never checked there lately. But anyway, the case seemed to end there, but there was another component to this thing that would take so long to get into that, I mean, that night there was at least, as far as we know, some 60 UFO reports from around the southwestern part of Nova Scotia. If you cut Nova Scotia in half below a line drawn from Halifax over to a place called Truro, and then below that, there was UFO reports all over the place. And but the most significant ones are the ones over in the Bay of Fundy. Mm-hmm. The Quadrille was a herring seiner boat along with a bunch of other boats that were out there. They were pulling their, it looks like the little city on the sea when they're all lit up and they're bringing the herring in because they circle.
Oh, yes. I've seen that.
With their nets and they got these big, you know, floodlights shining on the water and stuff. And the crew out there, boy, I just forgotten the skipper's name after all these years. Can you imagine? I'm getting old. Anyway, he noticed that the activity seemed to drop off, and he was in the wheelhouse, and he went out to see what was going on, and everybody's staring up at the sky, and he's just about to yell at these guys. He looks up, and he sees these two objects in the sky. And one separates and heads off down to the southwest, further down Bay of Fundy, and the other one crosses over towards New Brunswick to the right. As per your instructions, I'm keeping this really brief. There's a lot more detail in this. Anyway, if you follow further to the south, there's a group of people sitting around outside that night. Even though it's cool, they're sitting out in the veranda and they're listening to the marine radio. And then all of a sudden, one of the boats from Briar Island down there, Westport Briar Island, starts yelling to his other companion boat that I'm being buzzed by something here, and the thing is really low. It's coming right over top of my boat, and it's you know, scaring them.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't learn this until we got a letter some years later. Mm-hmm. Closer to that, down in a place called South Maitland, a Mountie and four game wardens are sitting out. Again, they've got a clearing staked out, and they're looking for deer jackers down in South Maitland. And they're sort of chatting away. This is around, they figured around quarter after to 20 after 11 that evening. And all of a sudden, they realize the conversation's dying off. And the reason for it is that they're all staring out through the window looking up at the sky. This thing slowly crosses over their car up about, they figured, 1,000 feet or so. A glowing, flickering type object. And it crosses over the car and it heads off toward, down towards the, slightly to the south southeast. The next day, me, Ian Andrew, the RCMP officer, goes over to, having learned what happened over in Shag Harbor the night before, goes over to see Bert Green, who was the chief, the lead game warden for that area over in, he's over in Bear River, and he goes into the office, and Bert has just finished drawing a line over the clearing that we're in and the direction this object was going. He says, look, like this thing was going, it looks like it was heading down towards the southeast, would have gone over somewhere around Shag Harbor. And Ian says, well, it's funny you should mention that because there was a big kerfuffle last night over in Shag Harbor. The Mounties and a bunch of people witnessed an object, something crashed into the water over there. So, you know, you sort of got this line of direction. And then this... that's heavily documented. All that stuff's documented, mm-hmm. right? And then you get the story, which is the other end of this thing off of what might have happened off of Shelburne and so on and so forth. I don't know if you've got time for that or not. But
you mean when they were trying to track it underwater? This is what I think is really fascinating.
Well, it is. That's the fascinating part of the story, sort of a hook for everybody else. They want to know what's going on there, but, I mean, it'll take me an hour to get through all of that. But essentially what happened is it appears that and this is all hindsight, that this thing that apparently landed on the water at Chagar, but didn't crash into it because there's witnesses around to say at least two. Well, one's passed away now, but the other one's a woman who at the time was 17 or 18 years old with her boyfriend parked right beside the Irish Moss plant on the other side that nobody knew about, and we didn't find out about until about 6 years ago. And they watched this thing come down and land on the water, and it scared the hell out of them. And then all of a sudden, you know, they thought, well, we better get out of there, and you know what they were sort of up to. They were just getting ready to leave when all of a sudden the car pulled into the parking lot, which would have been Laurie Wickens and his crew. So they got stuck there. And then they were trying to get out of there, and the people kept showing up, you know. And one of the military radio operators, Ted Lowe, who was operating radio that night, was handling the radio traffic between RCC and the military, said that when I contacted him, he says, of course, you know that two objects went into the water that night at Shag Harbor. And I said, well, I'm beginning to suspect it because I've got witnesses to indicate to me that there was two objects, not one. Hmm. And that explains why Norm Smith saw the object just going over the trees, and his father runs in and gets his clothes on, which only took a couple of minutes. And in the meantime, the RCMP cars go tearing by them when they go out to get into their car to go down the harbor. The two RCMP cars are going. They're already going down to the harbor because there's already an object down there, right? So now we got another one, apparently. Mm-hmm. And then there was a switch tender, a guy working for the Southwestern Railroad. He was getting off duty. He was heading down to Woods Harbor. His last name was Nickerson. His name's in the book. I forget his first name right at the moment. And he since passed away in 1991 from brain cancer. But anyway, he all of a sudden he saw two moons in the sky. So he stops his car and he gets out and he looks up at this thing, and there's the moon and this other object, which parted and crossed the sky in front of him, and went down and landed in the water in front of the Irish Moss plant. He was parked right across the street from it, and then all of a sudden the car came roaring in onto the parking lot, and he thought, I better get out of here. And he didn't know what was going on. He thought something weird was going on. So he got in his car and he headed, and there was a reason for that, and headed down to Lower Woods Harbor. It turns out that he was apparently having an affair with some woman down in Lower Woods Harbor. And when he got off duty, he was going there instead of going home. And his daughter attested to the fact that him and his wife had been having problems for years and were estranged almost. But anyway, he got out of there. Now, the thing of it is, he thought he saw the moon and one other object, but there was no moon that night. The moon, we determined the moon had set that night at 5:25 p.m. in the afternoon, mm-hmm. at least for that area of Nova Scotia, right? So now we keep getting these reports of like two landed on the water. The story now, and this is what we call it, this is a story from, but the story is coming from the military, not from civilian witnesses, that the object did go in to the water there, and then it went up the coast underwater, apparently about 23 miles, and settled onto the bottom off of McNutt's Island, which is an island in the mouth of Shelburne Harbor. Now, Shelburne Harbor is significant in the fact that it's on shore. There's what's called, they used to call it Government Point down there, but it was CFS Shelburne, Canadian Forces Station Shelburne. And it was supposed to be a Canadian-American oceanographic research area, right? Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, have you ever heard of SUSOS?
No.
Well, SUSOS was one of the biggest secrets of the Cold War, which was they'd salted the entire North Atlantic, the Pacific. The Americans said they spent billions of dollars on this with microphones. All right, so they could hear and computerize the signatures coming from the propeller and the hull of a boat going through the water and determine where Russian submarines were. Mm-hmm. Not only theirs, but ours too. And there's a lot of detail here. Johnny Walker, one of your spies down in the States, I believe it was 1994, had been arrested, and they found out that for 17 years he'd been giving away the secrets for Sousa that the Russians didn't even know about. But back then, when they did find out about it, they would run their submarines, their surface ships, their destroyers, aircraft carriers, whatever the heck the Soviets had, the Soviet bloc had that was going out to sea. And when they bring them in off of a tour, they would do something to the hull, like maybe weld something on it, do something to the prop, change the pitch of the prop a bit, or put a nick or something in it. And then when the vessel went out again, it would have a different sound signature. Hmm. And it would get re-recorded all over again. At the end of the Cold War, the United States Navy had determined that the Russians had four times more nuclear submarines than they did. As it turns out, they had about the same number, not four times more, but they were clever enough to do. They kept that secret to themselves and just used it to their own advantage, right? They tracked down that, the Glomar Explorer tracked down that Russian sub that might have been a rogue and might have been responsible for the book Red October in the Pacific, by using echolocation from those microphones. The U.S. Navy was able to find the Russians' own sub. They didn't know where it was down. They were looking 2,000 miles to the source, to the north, I should say. But anyway, I'm getting off track here. But that was there, and then the magnetic anomaly detection grid that ran along from Labrador down into offshore in the United States, which was a one-mile grid of wires that would detect the hull magnetic signatures as they're traveling over, and they get pinpointed more. The limit, the offshore limit back in those days was only 12 miles off Nova Scotia. It's 200 now. But back in those days, the Russians could get within, the Soviets could get within 12 miles of our coast, and they did all the time. They had those, what they call fishing boats. They look pretty much the same size of ours, but they're festooned with radar and radio antennas and everything. So they were basically just off the 12-mile limit, and sometimes they could come into the harbor in Halifax and revitalize, and there was no law against that part, but because we couldn't actually prove that they were spy ships, but everybody suspected they were. But anyway, these things apparently settled on right off of a top secret base, right? It turns out it was top secret. The Canadians were just guarding and supplying, food services and, you know, that sort of stuff to the base. Eventually they took it over in the 60s. But up until that point, nobody even realized that the Americans had bought this place back in 1949, the area. And, so we've got, an electronic intelligence officer aboard an Argus, which is a maritime patrol aircraft in Canada here, that with the tail boom, and it could detect submarines and by dropping sword on buoys and all this sort of thing. They were tracking this something underwater as well, working with the Americans, and which they said was unusual for the day, because we were flying in and out of their airspace, and they were flying in and out of our airspace without having to constantly go through the ongoing clearing of paperwork and so on and so forth. This was a declared an emergency of some sort. The military weapons expert who had given testimony, the diver who we mistakenly found, or Chris actually mistakenly found, thinking he was one of the divers in Shea Harbor from the Fleet Diving Unit. Indeed, they were from the Fleet Diving Unit, but they were on a different mission entirely and didn't know any, and they knew about Shea Harbor, but said, no, we weren't there. We were on camped over this thing off of McNutt's Island that was on the bottom and at about 80 feet of water. There was two of them down there. One seemed to be lending aid to the other. And one of the divers, the one that actually talked, said that there were creatures down there. That's how he described them. This is where we get into the sort of little alien connection there, right, if there is anything to the Shea Harbor. But that's what he called them, creatures. One seemed to be helping the other. And they had photographed it, and the diver who photographed it lives up in Upper Canada now. He's probably getting pretty old, and he won't talk at all. I tried to talk to him. He just completely gets angry and blows me right off. Said, no, you know, I can't talk about it. And this is what we kept getting. And there's no documentation on any of that. This is all, we call it the story. And and then there's the other military guy who was during the day was an RCAF aircraft, working on aircraft. They were engineers, aircraft engineers. And he was taken out, and he was put on a boat, and they sat out there for 7 days off McNutt's Island. And he was kept below decks. He wasn't allowed to know what was going on. All he heard was the divers talking about what they'd seen on the bottom and so on. And then an American officer on a Canadian ship, imagine, comes in and reams them out during a mess at the evening mess in the galley, and tells them to keep their goddamn mouth shut. They're not supposed to be talking about this even amongst themselves, you know. And I said, an American officer on a Canadian warship? What the hell's he doing getting more orders on a Canadian warship? And they said, I don't know, but he was. So there was that connection there. The fishermen in Shag Harbor had mentioned that day, the following day and the days after, that there was a couple of American submarines just drifting off the mouth of the sound there, while they were searching for whatever they were searching for. And but we weren't able to verify that. We were able to verify a Canadian sub that was coming across from England and by the shipping news, and that was supposed to be going to Halifax and was diverted to Shelburne. And on that same day, and various other things that go on. I know you're pushed for time here, Martin. So anyway, the upshot of this thing seems to be, according to the electronic intelligence officer on board that Argus and the military weapons expert, that an object was detected by NORAD coming in from Siberia over northeastern Canada. It was coming at about a speed of about 7,700 miles an hour. Airplanes were scrambled out of North Bay, Ontario, and out of Goose Bay, Labrador, to intercept, because this thing, they thought, was a missile. Who would, back in those days, an ICBM? You're at the height of the Cold War. War nerves are bad in those days. This was only a few years after, the Cuban Missile Crisis, after all. So, 5 years. And so anyway, it came in, got somewhere around Ellesmere Island, and apparently it stopped and hovered. They recalled their aircraft because they knew then there's no such thing as an ICBM that can stop and hover. It hovered there for perhaps a minute or two, and then it started to come in at about 4,400 miles an hour, gradually slowing down as it came. It went down through eastern Quebec, across northern New Brunswick, across the Bay of Fundy, and through the Nova Scotia, and went and disappeared out of sight around Shag Harbor, and at an altitude above that. Now, you're looking at all of the radar that was set up back in those days. There was the old dew line, which I think by 67 had been cut down, but the mid radar line across central Canada, and then the one across, basically across the Canadian-U.S. border, right through into Nova Scotia, they were still in operation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the upshot of that, and that whatever it was doing, apparently had some purpose to come in. They figured it had made a half an orbit and come in out of space and then down over Siberia and then across northern Canada. It would be great to be able to prove this beyond any shadow of a doubt, but we had no proof whatsoever other than anecdotal evidence coming from the military. Two of these guys that were threatened, three actually, now that I think of it, three guys were threatened to keep their mouths shut about this. One who was about to appear on a popular television series in the United States and Canada, which was called Sightings back in the mid-90s, who was supposed to appear on the show, to be interviewed when they were up here in Nova Scotia. And he got a call from a ranking officer, identifying himself as a ranking officer from DND, Department of National Defense, in Ottawa, and that they understood he was going to appear as a witness on a television show from the United States, and that we're holding you to your affidavit when you signed off with the Canadian Air Force, Royal Canadian Air Force, and we will bring proceedings against you if you don't keep your mouth shut.
Wow. Yeah.
So, but we didn't know that at the time. Chris didn't ask him why, because he called Chris and told him, and Chris said, "Oh, I'm sorry, disappointed about that." It was when I was re-interviewing a couple years later to find out all of this stuff. And I contacted him, and then I asked him, I said, why did you bail out of that thing? And that's when he told me the story. He said, I'd been sitting there that night eating my supper, and at 6 o'clock, phone rang, and this guy identified himself. Now, I thought, this sounds kind of weird. I can't, you sort of trust, you know damn well there's stuff going on in the military that you're never ever going to know about, right? Mm. That's a given. But you think, start to wonder about something. This is a UFO report and a pretty hefty story as it goes, and this guy's being told to stay away from him, keep his mouth shut. So we scoot ahead to about 6 years ago on a totally unrelated case. A military officer, retired, who was an engineer in the Canadian Army, asked me if I would meet a fellow retired military officer, a retired major in the Canadian Army, because he wanted to talk to me about something that happened to him back in 95. So, and just quickly on this, because it sort of verifies what had happened before. He told me about his case coming back. It was classic viewing an object, broad daylight, missing time, the whole nine yards. And this guy was a decorated soldier. He'd been wounded twice in action and so on and so forth. And told me this event that happened to him. But the upshot of it was the engineer, had told him that, I'd written a book about the Shag Harbor incident and about, and I said, yeah, we had a lot of problems with you guys up in D&D, I said, interfering with investigations, and I was trying to talk to witnesses and them to being told to shut up, And he says, oh, I've done that. And I said, what? I said, you've called people, military personnel and told them not to talk about UFO incidents? He said, no, not about UFOs, he said, but in this particular case, he said, but on four different occasions, I was ordered to call up an ex-military man or a military man and identify myself as a ranking officer at D&D in Ottawa and tell them that we understand you're going to testify or write about this, and we're telling you now not to do it or we will proceed against you, mm-hmm. and threaten them. Mm-hmm. Basically. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I'll be GD'd. I said, really? You actually do that? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, that's verification, And so, anyway, I just throw that in there to show you that, I mean, we'd be babes in the woods not to believe that that doesn't happen, that witnesses right. haven't been threatened and so on. We've heard enough about that over the years in this field.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Particularly when you get involved with stuff, that seems to be so intense and involving secret military projects and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. As I said, I once spent 3.5 hours telling this story, the whole thing, from beginning to end at a community college in Halifax, and I was practically had laryngitis by the time I finished. That's how long it takes to get through this case, right? There's so much detail to it.
All right, thanks so much. So this is Martin Willis with Don Ledger, and that's it for today.